Evening, everybody.
Let's cultivate our motivation to start out with. And to recall once again the great privilege and fortune and opportunity we have with our present life. How difficult it is and how much we must have done in previous lives to create the karma, all the causes and conditions for us to have this present opportunity. So whoever we were over many previous lives did something really good. So let's not squander it this lifetime by getting distracted and involved with attachments and aversions that concern only the things of this life and that have no lasting meaning or purpose or value. And so let's use our opportunity really to aim for full enlightenment and to develop that heart of loving kindness equally towards everybody, as well as the wisdom directly realizing reality, which will completely cleanse all the afflictions from our mind stream, so that as a Buddha we'll be able to most effectively be of service. So even that, though Buddhahood may be a long way away, no harm in aiming for it. No loss to hold that as our long-term purpose. And so let's do that, and then, moment to moment, create the causes, however big or small, for that Buddhahood to come about. Last week we looked briefly at this new text, a presentation of the establishments of mindfulness by Jeetsen Chukyi Gyaltsen, and we went through the whole text in a very abbreviated way just to get a sense of what's in it. There's one thing that I want to comment on. And it was on point number 4 when it talks about the nature of the four mindfulnesses. It says the definition of the establishment of mindfulness is an exalted knower of a person. I checked some other translations, and instead of exalted knower, it said knowledge. And I don't have the Tibetan text to know what term it is, but I have a feeling it's not exalted knower, because usually exalted knowers speak about the direct realization of emptiness, which is on the path of seeing and above. And yet when we look down on the point number 6 on boundary, it says the establishments of mindfulness exists from the path of accumulation through the Buddha's ground. So therefore, you know, it couldn't mean if the translation is yeshi, the Tibetan word is yeshi, it couldn't mean a mind that directly realizes emptiness, because the bodhisattvas on the path of accumulation, path of preparation, don't have that. So it refers to a more general kind of knowledge of somebody on the path. Okay, I just wanted to correct that, and hopefully one day we'll get the Tibetan text, we can see what the actual term is. Okay. So, I want to spend this session talking a little bit about the context in which we're going to look at these four establishments of mindfulness because, you know, as we know, context is very important. If you take something out of the context, you're going to get a whole different result and a whole different thing is going to go on. Okay? So this practice, when we think of the Lam Rim and we think of the three capacities of being, you know, the initial capacity being who is aimed for a good future rebirth, the middle capacity being who is aimed for liberation, and the great capacity being who is motivated to attain full enlightenment. This practice of the four establishments of mindfulness is first taught in the middle, for the middle capacity being. But we shouldn't make a mistake and think that it's only practiced by people who aim for liberation, because it's also practiced by bodhisattvas who aim for full enlightenment. Okay? So when we're engaging in the practice of the four mindfulnesses, if it's the practice of a middle capacity being, then we should have developed some kind of qualities already and have a certain kind of mind state or mental state to approach this practice in the correct way. Okay? So it's not just a practice that you sit down and do as a beginner who knows absolutely zero about Buddhism. I mean, you can do it that way, but you're going to get a very different result than if you do it within the a Buddhist context and having, you know, that knowledge of the initial level practitioner and the middle level practitioner. Okay, so the basic context that we have in doing this is one of the Four Noble Truths. Okay, so this practice is not separate from the Four Noble Truths. In fact, it's part of the true path, the fourth noble truth. But in the first noble truth, we're really looking at our situation of being in samsara. And many people think that samsara is, or cyclic existence, is something outside of themselves. You know, like this world is samsara, or other people are samsara, you know, or maybe samsara is a perfume. Yeah. Isn't it a perfume named samsara? So, no, okay, when we talk about samsara or cyclic existence, it refers to our five aggregates that are taken under the control of ignorance, afflictions, and karma. So this body is samsara, okay? The present mind that we have that's completely polluted by ignorance and misapprehensions and misconceptions and nutty emotions and wrong views, that's samsara. Samsara is not this world, okay? So when we say we live in samsara, it's very literally we're living in this body, okay? So don't think of it as someplace external, and oh, you know, as soon as they finally get that shuttle to the moon, you know, and allow tourists to go, then I'll go up to the moon and I'll be free of samsara. No. Okay. And people sometimes have that attitude about going to a monastery. Oh, you're going to leave all your problems behind. Well, no, as long as you take your body and mind with you, your problems are with you. Yeah, wherever you go, whatever you do. So, you know, samsara is quite a serious state. And what's so interesting is that we don't really understand the situation we're in. You know, even if we hear teachings about it, it kind of like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But we don't really get it, you know, how serious the situation is. And instead, what we think is really serious is, you know, losing our job or a relationship breaking up, or, you know, having health problems. But from a Buddhist viewpoint, well, those things are serious in terms of this lifetime. After this lifetime, they're gone. And even within this lifetime, they're gone. But the thing of being in samsara, of being under the control of ignorance, afflictions, and karma, that's not just this lifetime, it goes to next lifetime, and it keeps going into all the future lifetimes until we do something about it. Okay? So it's hard for us to really see the seriousness, and especially when the first noble truth is translated as the noble truth of suffering, which is a really bad translation. And I've noticed over the years that it leads many people to have a wrong understanding of Buddhism, because you read in these books, life is suffering. Okay? And people scratch their head and say, life isn't suffering, I'm having a good time. What are they talking about? There's plenty of happiness in life. You know, these Buddhists are so pessimistic. Either that, or when we hear the English word suffering, I don't know how it is in other languages, but we think of physical suffering or the very kind of painful mental suffering. In other words, we think of ouch. Yeah? But that's not just what this First Noble Truth is referring to. Because everybody, even our kiddies, they want to be free of the ouch kind of suffering. You know, that the pain of just physical pain, mental pain. Yeah, that hurts. But that's not the only thing we mean by dukkha. Okay, which is the Sanskrit word that's often translated as suffering. And that's what I find sometimes. And, you know, we kind of go along in our life, oh, everything's good, everything's good. Then we hear about a friend who's getting sick and something else happened to another good friend. And then we go, oh, life is so full of suffering. But then when our friend's problems pass, then we're back in our kind of nice, you know, automatic state of life is kind of fun, you know. I mean, it's beautiful outside and we can eat ice cream and, you know, sure glad it's not me that's suffering. Okay? So this is the difficulty that comes up with this translation of dukkha as suffering, is people become very narrow and think it only refers to physical and mental pain, whereas it doesn't. Okay, it's much, much broader than that. So physical mental pain is one level. That's very gross. Like I said, everybody wants to be free of that. But, you know, from a Buddhist viewpoint, there's another grade of suffering called, or grade of dukkha, let's use the word dukkha, which is the dukkha of change, yeah, which is what we ordinarily call happiness. Okay. Now we get confused. Wait a minute, you're telling me happiness is suffering? No, I'm not saying suffering. I'm saying ordinary happiness is dukkha. It's unsatisfactory in the sense that if it were real happiness, the more we did the activity that produced it, the happier we should get. Okay? So when we're hungry, then we think eating is happiness. It cures the pain of the hunger. If eating were real happiness, then the more we eat, the happier we should be. But we've all continued to eat and eat when we shouldn't have, and we know that instead of being happier, we become more miserable. So what's actually happening with the dukkha of change is that we had a situation in which there was some discomfort or pain. we change the external situation. And by changing the external situation, this pain started to lessen. In the meantime, another pain started to grow stronger and stronger. Okay? So the pain of being hungry diminishes, but the pain of being too full begins. And they happen at exactly the same time. Okay? So there's no real happiness in that situation, because whichever way you go, you're going to eventually meet pain. And so when we think of any of the situations, you know, with that our ordinary mind considers happy and blissful, if we think of doing it again and again and again without any respite, it does become painful. Okay? So it's the same thing when we're tired, we lie down and go to sleep. If that were really happiness, we could keep sleeping, we could keep lying down, we'd be happier and happier. But if you had to lie down all day, you'd go crazy, wouldn't you? You want to get up. So then you get up, and the suffering of lying down has started decreasing. But the suffering of being up has started from small and is getting bigger. And eventually, you know, becomes really intolerable, and you have to lie down again. Okay. We were just talking about relationships. You know, any relationship we have with somebody, it might be really wonderful, but if you were with that person 24/7, what would happen? Okay? If you were with your family, you know, your mother, your child, or a very good friend, 24/7, day after day, is that going to bring you lasting happiness? No, you're probably going to go nuts. Okay? So we can see really clearly here that, you know, we may be very attached to somebody and think, oh, if I'm only with that person, then I'll really be happy. But if you're with that person day after day or minute after minute with no respite, boy, you know, after not too long, you're going to say, oh, get me out of here. I need some space. So it's like that with anything we experience in samsara. Yeah, anything eventually is going to transform into a gross kind of painful situation. So that's called the dukkha of change. That gives us a whole different perspective about what to look for in life. Because usually the things of the dukkha of change are what we ordinarily consider happiness. You know? Getting a trophy, getting a good job, winning a championship, getting elected to an office, having a relationship, having sex, eating, going on vacation. Any of these things, if we think of them and doing them continuously, yeah, they're going to turn into a very, very difficult, painful situation, aren't they? Okay? So that shows us that within cyclic existence like that, looking for external things that are going to fill this hole inside is fruitless. Looking for external things or external people who are going to soothe our problems and fulfill our needs is useless, because none of that is going to bring us lasting happiness. Yeah, it may bring us some happiness for a short while, but, you know, if we have too much of it, then it turns into pain. If we have too little of it, then we experience the pain of longing and missing and wanting and craving. Okay. Then there's also a third kind of dukkha, which is the dukkha It's called pervasive conditioned dukkha. And that just, that means basically having a body and mind under the control of ignorance, afflictions, and karma. Yeah, not having freedom. Now we say, what are you talking about? I have so much freedom in my life. You know, there's the Constitution that protects my freedom. And we celebrate it every 4th of July. You know, we're free. Okay. But are we really free? As long as we have this kind of body, are we really free? Can you do whatever you want? Yeah. Are you free from aging, sickness, and death? Are we free from having problems? Are we free from, you know, being dissatisfied? Are we free from disappointment? No. Are we even free to really choose what we want? Or do we all have certain aspects of our personality in which we're really like junkies, where we do the same thing just on automatic? We can't break a bad habit. So some people have illegal addictions. You know, they take drugs, or they drive where they're drunk. Other people have legal addictions. Okay? So they think they're not addictions. But look at us. You know, the things that we choose to do over and over again when we're unhappy, or the things we choose to do over and over again thinking that they're really going to, you know, bring us some fulfillment. Are we free from those kind of habitual actions? Are we? No. You know? And how much during the day do we just act on automatic? You know, we can see how difficult this is, you know, because every evening we look over our day's action, we do some confession about the mistakes we made, and make a very strong determination of, you know, okay, tomorrow I'm not going to trash anybody behind their back, or tomorrow I'm not going to complain to anybody, or tomorrow I'm going to, you know, try and reach out and be nice to this person I've been avoiding. But tomorrow comes, and what happens? You know? There we are, doing the same old thing again and again and again, even though we said to ourselves just a few hours before, I'm not going to do this. Yeah? So are we really free? Are we free from the habit of these afflictions? You know? From habitual behaviors that don't really bring the happiness that we want. Okay. We may be free to go out and drink and drug, but are we free in our heart to go out and drink and drug? No, we're completely, you know, bound by our attachment. We may be free to go out with our friends and have a good time, but are we free inside from the attachment that craves for amusement, or the attachment that craves for somebody else to, you know, fill the sense of emptiness in our own heart? We're not. Okay? So this third type of dukkha, the pervasive conditioned dukkha, is really talking about that lack of freedom that we have that comes from being overpowered by ignorance, afflictions, and then the karma we create. Okay? So that's describing the first and second noble truth. Yeah, those three types of dukkha describe the first noble truth, the truth of dukkha, and the ignorance, afflictions, and karma are the second noble truth, the truth of the origin of dukkha. Okay? So those are the first two noble truths. Those are the ones we want to put behind us. Those are also the ones that are most difficult for us to think about with wisdom, because we're junkies for pleasure and bliss. And we even come into the Dharma and we want talk of light and love and bliss and, you know, this kind of stuff. And Buddha says, start with the first and second noble truths. You know? Why? Because he wants us to really understand what our situation is. Because only when we understand the prison that we're in will we want to be free of it. When we don't completely understand the prison we're in, then there's no motivation to be free. Okay? We just kind of continue to hang out in the same situation, just trying to tweak our samsara, make it a little bit nicer. Okay, but we're not really dealing with the basic situation. And sometimes we get so confused in our samsara that when we're shown the gate that goes out of prison, when we're shown the Dharma teachings that will lead us to liberation, we run away from them. Yeah? Anybody ever experienced resistance in their practice? Yeah? So this is one of our turkey teachings. We have a series every winter when the turkeys come live in our garden. And they are very good Lam Rim teachers. So if you've ever watched turkeys, you know, really closely, they have to be together in a group. Yeah, they have to be together. You'd think they were a bunch of teenagers, you know? just have to be together. And when they're separated from the group, they really get terribly afraid and really freaked out. Okay? And so we'll see, you know, because we have a fence around the yard, and we'll open the gate out there, and maybe one turkey will fly over the fence, and then a second turkey will go join them. And then pretty soon all the other turkeys who are inside the fence want to go outside the fence, but they don't know how, even though they've just watched their friends fly over the fence. And they'll run around the edge of the fence looking for a way out, but as soon as they get near where the gate is, where all they have to do is walk through the gate, they turn around and go back. It's fascinating, you know? And yet they're suffering so much and they want to be on the other side of the fence, but they go in the opposite direction. And they can't see their friend, you know, they can't get it that my friend flew over, I can too. Yeah. It's incredibly interesting to watch. So this is kind of like us. Yeah? The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas come along and say, you know, here's the Dharma, it'll lead you to liberation. And we go, and run away, you know, hugging the fence the whole time around, saying, where's the opening? I want to get out. I want to be with my friends. Where's the opening? But the opening was right there, with a Buddha standing in front saying, just walk through here. And we're like the turkeys and go the opposite direction. In our panic, in our stress, you know? And we're not seeing all the bodhisattvas who have flown over, you know, and crossed to the other side, who were just like us, who we were hanging out with a minute ago. And instead we just stay stuck in our complete panic and fear, and yet we run away from the very thing that is going to liberate us. Okay? So, when they say that we lack freedom, this is what we're talking about. It's not political freedom. It's freedom in our heart. It's the freedom to be free of ignorance, clinging, and anger. Yeah. But we aren't free of that. Okay, so we have to understand that as a basis before we even get involved in the four practices for establishments of mindfulness. Okay? So we have to understand that's our situation. Now, why are we practicing the four foundations of mindfulness? Well, they fall under the true path. Okay? So we just talked about the first two noble truths. We're going to talk about the last two. So the true path is the path that's going to take us out of the dukkha. It's the path that's going to eliminate the origin of dukkha, the ignorance, and especially craving, and also anger. Okay? So the true path is the method to follow. It's the realizations that we want to generate in our mind, because those realizations will be our true refuge. When we have those Dharma realizations in our mind, then, you know, ignorance, anger, and attachment can't affect us. Yeah. So the true path is what we want to practice, what we want to actualize. It's a complete transformation of our mind. And by practicing that, then we'll arrive at true cessations, okay, which are the cessations of various levels of dukkha and various levels of their origin, the ignorance and afflictions and karma. Okay? So, you know, the true path is really what is, you know, we all talk about we want to be saved. You know, some people want to be saved spiritually, some people want to be saved psychologically, some people play the role of, you know, the rescuer and the savior. But what really saves us is the realization of the true paths in our own mind. So the four foundation, the four establishments of mindfulness are a practice that, when we get very, very deep in that practice, becomes the true paths, those mental states that will free us. Okay? So here we see that when we're talking about establishing mindfulness, it clearly doesn't just mean bear attention on what we're doing. And when we were talking last week, there was the one part of the text that said, what is the establishment of mindfulness? It is wisdom. Mm-hmm. Okay? So we see very clear how the practice of the establishment of mindfulness generates wisdom. That wisdom, especially the wisdom realizing the emptiness, is the true path. And that wisdom will eliminate the afflictions and the dukkha, so that we arrive at nirvana, which is the fulfillment of all the true cessations, the accumulation of all the true cessations, which is the third noble truth. Okay? So that's how this practice fits within the idea of the four noble truths. Now, some people think that the practice of the four establishments of mindfulness is only a practice done by people who are doing the fundamental vehicle practice. In other words, hearers and solitary realizers who are aiming for their own liberation, for arhatship. And they say, oh, that's practice done by those people who are so selfish and just looking for their own liberation. You know, it's not a practice that I do. I'm a bodhisattva. That's saying that is basically showing our ignorance, okay? Because the four foundation, the four, I don't know why I keep saying foundations, the four establishments of mindfulness, you know, are done not only by followers of the fundamental vehicle who seek their own liberation, but also they're done by Mahayana practitioners, by people following the Bodhisattva vehicle who are aimed for full enlightenment. The thing what's different is, of course, your motivation. Okay? So you can do this practice motivated by the thought of, I want to be free of samsara. Or you can do the exact same practice motivated by the thought of, I want to attain full enlightenment, for the benefit of all living beings. And according to what our motivation is, that will be the effect of doing that practice. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean that just that practice alone will bring you either liberation or enlightenment. The path is much more complex than just doing one practice. Okay? His Holiness Dalai Lama is always saying, our mind is something very complex. We can't just think one practice is going to solve everything. We need a number of different practices, you know, that really counteract different, you know, disturbances in our mind. So, just the four foundations of mindfulness alone won't bring either. Four establishments of mindfulness alone won't bring either liberation or enlightenment. Okay, if we're practicing the here and solitary realizer vehicle, then we need renunciation. We need the very sincere wish to be free of cyclic existence. If we're practicing the bodhisattva vehicle, then we need renunciation and bodhicitta, okay, as our motivation. That's just talking about the motivation side. Okay? What do we also need? We also need the correct kind of wisdom. Yeah? And so we see in Buddha's teachings, there's different levels of wisdom that the Buddha talked about. When he talked about selflessness, there were many different kinds of selflessnesses that he talked about at differing levels. And what we need to attain either liberation or enlightenment, full enlightenment, is the selflessness, to realize the selflessness of persons and the selflessness of phenomena according to the Prasangika Madhyamika view. Okay, so we need to realize the emptiness of inherent existence, of all persons and all phenomena. It's another component that we need, okay, in these four establishments. And that specific kind of wisdom, not just the wisdom realizing the absence of a self-sufficient, substantially existent person, not just the wisdom realizing the non-existence of some kind of permanent, unitary, autonomous soul or self. Okay? It's a much deeper kind of wisdom. Okay. What else do we need? Yeah? Besides renunciation, bodhicitta, wisdom. Okay? What we need on a day-to-day life, day-to-day basis, is ethical conduct, because that's the foundation of the whole practice. And this is really, really important, because what we see a lot in the West is, you know, because we're people who have had a secular education, so we feel, you know, I'm kind of educated, I know something, I'm ready for the highest teachings, the most profound teachings. You know, I want to hear about the union of bliss and emptiness, Dzogchen, Mahamudra, and everything all put together, because I am extremely intelligent and will understand it all. And so we go to all those teachings and we learn a lot of words that sound incredible. You know, the extremely subtle mind, which is one nature with the extremely subtle wind. You know, and the practices of breakthrough and leap over, and the four empties, which are correlated with the four blisses. And we learn lots of vocabulary. It sounds fantastic, you know. But as soon as our teacher says, don't lie, it's like, you know, it's like, what are you talking about? You know, I'm going to do what I want. You know, yeah, I know lying isn't so good, especially when the politicians lie, especially when the CEOs lie, you know, especially when my partner lies. That lying is no good. But when I lie, you know, there's a profound reason for it. You know? And it's really for the benefit of sentient beings. Yeah, so that I don't want to hurt them, you know. So we're having amnesia about what the action we did was that we now feel compelled to lie about. Forget that one. Okay. And we have all this rationale about how what we're doing isn't real lying, and it's really compassion in action, a very profound practice, you know. But we can't help ourselves from lying. Okay. Or we've heard the highest teachings about this, that, and the other thing, and our teacher says, you know, stop using your sexuality unkindly and unwisely. And we go, what kind of prude is that? What century is that teacher coming from? You know, we are liberated. We have sexual freedom. I'm going to have sex with whoever I want to, whenever I want to. It's perfectly all right. You know? So, you know, we don't, when it comes to ethics, sometimes we are, you know, there's where we're really resistant, you know. And I'm like, don't tell me what to do, you know. I left the Ten Commandments, I don't want any more. Okay. So, you know, we desperately need ethical conduct. You know, if we think we're going to develop renunciation, bodhicitta, and wisdom without ethical conduct, then we are really lost. Okay, really lost. So we can see that, you know, there's a lot of other practices that we do together with the four establishments of mindfulness. This practice is one that's embedded in a whole world view. It's embedded in a whole way of living your life. It's embedded in teachings that come before it and teachings that come after it. Okay? So it's important to understand that, not just pluck it out of the context and think that we're going to get the same results. Yeah. I think you've heard me talk about, you know, there's many Zen masters, or no, there's many Catholics who do Zen meditation, and some are Zen masters. But you're going to get a whole different realization doing Zen meditation if you're a Catholic than you are if you're a Buddhist, because your whole conceptual framework, your whole worldview is totally different. Okay? So you have to be careful about those things. Okay, so they're called establishments of mindfulness because we should think about them for a long time, meaning we should establish ourselves in them. And we should familiarize ourselves with them and gain ascertainment. Okay, so we need to think about them, contemplate, meditate on them for a long time. So this isn't going to be a quick, cheap, and easy fix. Okay? Familiarize ourselves with them again and again. Familiarization takes time and repetition, doesn't it? Okay? And not just familiarize ourselves, but gain ascertainment. In other words, really penetrate them, really understand what they're trying to teach us. Okay? Like I said, they're included in the Four Noble Truths under True Paths. Actually, when we talk about True Paths, we often talk about the three higher trainings, the higher trainings in ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom. We also talk about the 37 harmonies with enlightenment. Okay, this is another group of practices that are done both by those on the fundamental vehicle, practicing that vehicle, and on the bodhisattva vehicle. So the 37 practices, these are not the 37 practices of bodhisattvas that we chant after lunch. Okay, these are the 37 harmonies with enlightenment, and they're broken down into seven groups. The first group is the four establishments of mindfulness. The second group is called the four right abandonments, or actually in when that's translated from the Pali, it's the four right strivings or the four right kinds of effort. Okay, the third group is called the four miraculous feats, or another translation is the four bases of spiritual power. The next group is called the five faculties, and the group after that is called the five powers. Then we have the seven enlightenment factors and the Eightfold Noble Path. Okay? So there's those seven groups, four, 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 five, five, seven, and eight. Okay? And so altogether that makes 37. Those are the 37 practices that are in harmony with enlightenment, whether we're talking about the enlightenment of a hearer, a solitary realizer, or a bodhisattva. Okay, but the four establishments of mindfulness are the first group within that, because that kind of forms the basis for all the other practices. Yeah, when we're skilled in the four establishments of mindfulness, we can progress on to the other practices. You know, and not abandoning the four establishments, but enriching them with the other six groups of practices. Okay? And what's interesting is in these, these seven groups that I was talking about, mindfulness comes in is one of the factors in five of them. There's only two where it's not one of the factors. Those are the four abandonments and the four miraculous feats. Yeah? But in all the other ones, mindfulness is one of the practices. Okay? So of the 37, yeah, four right at the beginning are mindfulness. And then you have four more. So eight of the 37 are mindfulness. You know, varieties of mindfulness. So mindfulness is something very important. And like I said, it's not just bare attention. It has to be conjoined with wisdom and ascertainment and understanding. Okay. So, what in the Tibetan tradition, they often take these seven groups, you know, of the 37 harmonies with enlightenment, and they correlate them with different phases of the path. Starting with the path of accumulation, going through the path, you know, the path of meditation. So the four establishments of mindfulness, okay, according to the Treasury of Knowledge, the Abhidharmakosha, they are emphasized on the path of accumulation. So that's right first when you first enter the path, either by generating renunciation, if you're following the hearer and solitary realizer path, or by generating bodhicitta, if you're doing the bodhisattva path. Okay? Or according to the treasury of the compendium of knowledge, then these four are emphasized on the small path of accumulation, because the path of accumulation has three phases. Okay? But in either rendition, regardless of whether we're following the Treasury of Knowledge, the Compendium of Knowledge, which, by the way, were written by brothers. Okay, Asanga and Vasubandhu, they were brothers. So, in either way, you know, we can see this is one of the first practices that somebody does once they've entered the path. But, like I was talking earlier, there's all this stuff that you have to do to just enter the path. And that's, you know, we're kind of working on all of that now. That doesn't mean that we wait until we enter the path to do this practice. We can start practicing it right now, you know, when we have some of the the correct worldview, the correct motivation and attitude. But then we really, it's really emphasized and really, bears a lot of fruit when we actually enter the path. So let me pause right now. You have any questions? Where are we? There's been a lot of topics. Yes?
Is it that those on the fundamental path enter the path when you generate renunciation?
Mm-hmm.
Those on the great vehicle enter the path when you generate bodhicitta.
Mm-hmm.
So a person who is generating bodhicitta, do they automatically have to have renunciation started there?
Okay. So does a person who's generating bodhicitta have to have renunciation? Yes. Yeah. But a bodhisattva, so if somebody who has bodhicitta, they're renouncing not only their own dukkha in cyclic existence, but the dukkha of all sentient beings. Okay. And they say, so you can see, because really to have the wish to exert the effort to become a fully enlightened Buddha, you have to really have a strong motivation. And so seeing the dukkha of all the countless sentient beings is going to be what, generates within you that intensity of compassion and the level of confidence and effort that we're going to need to actually actualize that. Now, to renounce all the dukkha of all sentient beings, we have to start with our own. Okay? So everything on the bodhisattva path, we have to start it with ourselves. Sometimes we get so into, I have love and compassion for all sentient beings, but I hate myself. Yeah? You meet people like that, don't you? People who so much want to help other people, so kind, so good-natured, want to help, but they can't stand themselves, and they fall into depression. So their quote-unquote bodhicitta is for all sentient beings minus one. It's not real bodhicitta. Okay? So before we can really have love and compassion for others, we have to have love and compassion for ourselves. Okay? And this means love and compassion according to the Buddhist meaning of love and compassion, not according to our worldly, ordinary meaning of love and compassion. Okay, so don't get that confused. Yeah, that's a whole other bag of worms. Okay? And so similarly, with generating renunciation of before I can want to renounce your suffering and want you to be free of suffering, I have to renounce my own. Yeah? Because, it's natural that we're more in touch with ourselves, aren't we? And we consider ourselves more important. So we have to start there and really see how we're embedded in cyclic existence and want ourselves to get free, and then just expand it and turn it to everybody else and say, oh, that's the situation of everybody else. So we may call it renunciation, but what it actually is compassion for ourselves. Okay? We often hear the word renunciation and we think of, suffering. Oh, Buddhism, I have to renounce chocolate cake, especially that fantastic chocolate cake Venerable Yeshe made last. I have to give that up for enlightenment. Oh, my God, how am I going to do that? Or I have to renounce, a bed, like one of those beds that the Abbey just bought, to lie in, I have to renounce a bed. Oh, my goodness. We're not talking about... That's not what we're talking about. Okay? There's nothing in Buddhism that says you have to give up pleasure. Okay? Pleasure is not our problem. Attachment to pleasure is our problem. Okay? So sometimes We stay away from pleasure because our mind is uncontrolled and we get attached to it. But the pleasure, that the happy feeling itself isn't the problem. Okay? What we're renouncing is attachment. Okay? So, you know, we have to renounce our own attachment, our own ignorance that leads to our own difficulties, and then spread it to other people. Okay? So renouncing that for ourselves, that's the real meaning of having compassion for ourselves. Okay? Because compassion is the wish for somebody to be free of suffering. When we renounce our own ignorance, attachment, and anger, what are we saying? We're saying, I care so much about myself that I want myself to actually be happy, not to keep on doing stupid things that don't really make me happy, but I really want myself to get to a level of permanent, lasting happiness. Yeah, that's real compassion for ourselves. And that's what renunciation of ignorance, anger, and attachment and dukkha is all about. Okay? So don't think of suffering as, I mean, of renunciation as, you know, some practice of ascetic suffering. Yeah, it's not. It's the real meaning, you know, of compassion for ourselves. Because when you think about it, isn't real compassion for ourselves wanting ourselves to have a kind of fulfillment and satisfaction and peace that's not going to disappear? Yeah? I mean, nowadays people say, oh, I have so much love for and compassion for myself that I went out to the store and I bought myself a present. Oh my goodness, what kind of nonsense. Yeah, that's not going to cure our problems, is it? That's not loving ourselves. Yeah, but we have to really want ourselves to be happy in the proper way, you know, and in the really long-term, final way of where we're going to be completely free and never fall back. Now that's the real kind of happiness. Okay?
Well, I have a context question about, because what I see is that this is citing the Abhidharma, but what about the Pali sutras that the fundamental vehicle bases the understandings of mindfulness?
Oh, yeah.
Where are they in relationship to this text? Or?
Oh, well, one of the sutras the Buddha taught was the Sutra on the Four Establishments of Mindfulness.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, I don't know if that sutra itself is actually in the Tibetan canon, because there's very few of the Pali sutras that the Tibetan canon took into it in the Sanskrit version. So a lot of the practices from it, I don't know. But a lot of the practices from it were summarized in the Abhidharma texts.
Mm-hmm.
So the Tibetans rely very heavily on the Abhidharma. In Abhidharma Kosha, the Treasury of Knowledge by Vasubandhu, it's in chapter 8, where he really goes through the four establishments of mindfulness. Okay? But of course, those texts are going to be relying on the same sutras that are in the Pali canon, because those texts were composed in India when they had access to all of those sutras. Okay, so it's quite interesting that we find that a lot of, you know, because when you really look at it, there's so much that's in the Pali canon that is also in the Tibetan canon. But a lot of the material that got into the Tibetan tradition got there via the commentators, not just the sutras. Okay? Mm-hmm. It was because the commentators in ancient India had those texts, extracted those parts, included them in their treatises, and those treatises came to Tibet. But you find within a lot of it. And then also what's interesting is you find some Mahayana sutras that are almost word for word in some passages the same as the Pali sutras. Okay, but it's a Mahayana sutra, like the sutra of the 10 grounds, you know, which is part of the flower ornament sutra, the Avatamsaka sutra. There's passages in that that are, you know, almost identical to what's in the Pali Canon. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
For people following the fundamental vehicle, would it be a natural progression to, I mean, if you're having a true realization of renunciation, mm-hmm. and you just look around and you see others experiencing the same sufferings, mm-hmm. wouldn't it kind of be a natural progression to
okay. So wouldn't it, the question is, wouldn't it be a natural progression if you generate renunciation for yourself to then look around and see everybody else is facing the same situation and generate bodhicitta? Not necessarily, because if prior to generating renunciation you've had a lot of teachings that, you know, it's not necessary to become a Buddha, that not everybody has the potential to become a Buddha, that, you know, the real important thing is to be free of cyclic existence yourself, and the only Buddhas are the 1,000 Buddhas of the fortunate eon, and those places have already been reserved. You know, so if you've had that kind of teaching beforehand, yeah, then you wouldn't necessarily spontaneously think, oh, I want to become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings. Yeah. There are some crossover points when you're in the fundamental vehicle where you can cross over to the bodhisattva vehicle. I forget them. Do you remember what they are? The points where if you're following, like here, a solitary realizer path, where you can cross over without becoming an arhat, cross over and start practicing the bodhisattva vehicle. I think so, but I'm not sure.
I mean, it's somehow mentioned that it takes much longer, and then you can enter the bodhisattva path, but it's like, I don't know how to cross the
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So maybe once you generate, yeah, maybe once you generate renunciation, you just go all the way to arhatship. We'll have to check on that and see. Yeah.
Last week you were talking about the difference between the hearer, solitary realizer, and bodhisattva, mm-hmm. in terms of the 5 paths. And you talked about the path of accumulation, like what we're speaking about tonight. The one had renunciation, the other had bodhicitta, and then at the end point, one was an arhat and one was a Buddha. Mm-hmm. But those steps in between, are they really, they're not really the same on each.
Well, the steps are the same in terms of the point that differentiates the path of accumulation from path of preparation on both vehicles is gaining a union of serenity and insight on a conceptual with a conceptual realization of emptiness. Okay, but see, that's the whole thing of context. Because you might have that realization, but it's going to be different if you're following the hearer vehicle than if you're following the bodhisattva vehicle. So that perception of emptiness, the emptiness you perceive is going to be the same, realizing emptiness is going to be the same, but they say that bodhisattvas realize it from using many, many different reasonings, from many different angles, and the hearers and solitary realizers don't. You know, and then the whole feeling of you know, having even that conceptual realization of emptiness is going to be very different if you have the motivation for your own liberation than if you have the motivation, yeah. And the level of merit that you've accumulated, too, is very, very different.
So there, where it might be different than is at the path of meditation, start removing innate obscurations.
Yeah. Well, they're both removing innate obscurations on the path of meditation, but the bodhisattvas are also going to remove the cognitive obscurations on the path of meditation. The hearers and solitary realizers won't.
Okay.
Okay.
Uh-huh. So what is a practitioner being who wants to progress on the Bodhisattva path from the between the time of the devout renunciation to the time of the devout bodhicitta. Is that they're just not on the path?
Yeah, they're not on the path. Yeah. Okay. But, you know, somebody who's aiming for the Bodhisattva vehicle, they're not going to generate the renunciation for their own liberation alone. Okay? They're always going to generate renunciation within the context of renouncing everybody's dukkha. So, actually, we have a lot of work to do just to get to the first path. Yeah? But that's okay, isn't it? You know, it doesn't matter how long it takes. Doesn't matter. I mean, I think the good thing is we know what the path is. We know what direction we're going in. And we have the tools. So, you know, it takes a long time. That isn't what's so important. The fact is we finally found the path and we have certainty about it.
Is there a point before the path of seeing where it's certain that one won't, fall to lower states or to veer off the path?
Well, they say that once you reach the middle state of a path of accumulation, you won't lose your bodhicitta after that. And then once you get to, what is it, the peak stage of path preparation, do you remember? Then you won't fall in the lower realms, you know, by old karma. So there's all these kind of things, you know, different stages, different levels of security you get. Yeah. You know, finally security. Oh, no more rebirth due to my own negative karma. Then path of seeing, that's on the path of preparation, no more lower rebirths due to my already created negative karma. Then path of seeing, oh, I'm not going to create any more negative karma for lower rebirths at all. That's really secure.
Uh-huh. And then the realization of impermanence suddenly mm-hmm. goes, falls from
yeah.
there in that sequence.
Yeah.
I mean, is it in the path, still in the path of accumulation?
Accumulation, or that can happen before, too.
Okay.
Actually, you can realize emptiness before you enter the path, too. And you can realize emptiness before you enter the path, too. You may not have the union of serenity and insight on it. But you can have a conceptual realization mm-hmm. of emptiness before you enter the path. They say that's what the high faculty bodhisattvas do.
Okay.
But we have to end. End on that note, tantalizing. I want a realization of emptiness before I even enter the path. It's possible. It's possible. Yeah? We have to do some work.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances, grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual masters be stable, and their divine actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the 3 worlds always increase.
Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamniryatayami. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain paradise, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Tenrezi, may you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Yashravasti Abbey in the West flourish. So when you're meditating on the dukkha, the way I explained it, you know, don't see it as something that's depressing. See it as something that's realistic. And the thing is, when you really understand it deeply, then it gives you actually a lot of vitality and enthusiasm in your life, because you let go of all the stupidagios that we usually get, you know, drawn into. And now we have a really clear purpose and direction in our life. So initially it sounds like, oh, so much dukkha and lack of freedom, you know, woe is me. But actually it's not. I think the understanding must bring just a tremendous sense of calm in the mind, as well as energy, you know, because we know where we're going finally, and we know what's important, you know, and we're not going to worry about stupid things anymore.